I'm Marty Moscoe-Wayne. Welcome back to Radio Times. It's one thing to have a healthy ego. It's another to be an egomaniac or to work for one. Steve Jobs was famous for being ruthless and insensitive, a master manipulator. You either loved or hated working with him. And it's not easy working for a boss with a big ego. They tend to think they're the smartest person in the room. They can't take criticism from others and often blame others when things go wrong. Today on Radio Times, ego at the workplace, when it's helpful and when it's destructive. And we have two guests who have joined us. Joining us by telephone is Robert Sutton. He's a professor of management science and engineering at the Stanford Engineering School, co-founder of the Center for Work Technology and Organization, author most recently of a book called Good Boss, Bad Boss. And Robert Sutton, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
It's great to be here.
Also with us and joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Nicole Lipkin. She's business and organizational consultant, a psychologist, I should say, founder of Equilibria Leadership Consulting, and she's also the author of a book titled What Keeps Leaders Up at Night, Recognizing and Resolving Your Most Troubling Management Issues. And Nicole Lipkin, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well.
Marty, it's a pleasure being here.
Nicole, have you ever worked for an egomaniac?
Oh, man, have I. Absolutely.
Is there something you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, it's actually the reason why I went into business for myself. But I will say I learned more from that bad boss and from that egomaniac in how to be a leader and what to do and what not to do than any other work experience that I ever had. So I do value that experience.
So what did you learn? What do you value? What did you value?
Well, I learned that treating people badly doesn't work. And even though we might lose it sometimes and we might leak out all over the place because we're having a bad day or we're under a lot of stress, you know, simple things like coming back and acknowledging it and recognizing it and then being self-aware enough to put the things in place to prevent it from happening again makes such a huge difference. I mean, people hold on to those moments that you leak out and attack them significantly more than the positive experiences. Actually, it takes about 5 positive experiences to make up for 1 negative, because that's the way our brain processes. We spend more time talking about and analyzing in harsher adjectives describing the bad moments or the bad experiences with people. That's why we hold on to it so much. You know, it's very easy to talk about your exes and your, you know, your child or the bad parts. It's harder to recall positive stuff.
Oh, that's interesting. Robert, so let me go to you. And just to make sure our listeners are, I guess, all basically on the same page, how would you describe or what are the features of a bad egomaniac boss?
Well, to me, a feature of a bad egomaniac boss is, as Nicole said, somebody who doesn't have enough self-awareness or control to the point where they're constantly making the people around them feel bad. And I would also add, this notion that people who are bad leaders consistently put their own needs ahead of the needs of their team, of their customers, of their organization. And to me, that's where the real trouble starts. And once we start talking about, if you will, what's the difference between a good and a bad egomaniac, that's where a lot of it lies. But that notion of it's all about me, and people who don't have self-control can really be a serious problem.
And how common do you think that is, Robert Sutton, in the world of work?
Well, if you look at the evidence, I guess the good news is that only about 10-15% of Americans will report that they're working for a bad boss, and maybe 35% of us have ever worked for a bad boss. But the challenge, and this gets into some of the stuff we're going to be talking about, is that when people are charismatic, and that includes narcissists, what happens is we start being attracted to them initially, and we tend to disproportionately put them in power. It might be especially bad in politics, by the way. Corporate America.
I think we're living through some of that, but yes.
Yeah, we are. Have a little bit more correction mechanisms.
Interestingly, and let me go back to you if I could, Nicole, and even picking up on what Robert was just saying there, the idea that someone with charisma, I mean, I would think in many ways people with a strong ego, whether it's healthy or destructive, could rise or often does rise to the top because that's what it takes to make it in the world of work.
Absolutely.
Yes, no?
Absolutely. I mean, having a healthy ego, talking about that first versus maladaptive, having
sure.
a healthy, you need a healthy ego. We all have egos. Ego is not good or bad. It's our self-concept, right? And it's which is shaped by our experiences and creates how we think and believe and how we see the world, right? So getting into a leadership position, it takes a lot of ego. It takes a lot of confidence to get in that position. Actually, it can be highly, highly motivating for people around you and very strong. But kind of as what Bob was saying, it's when you can't see from other people's perspectives. It's when you can't, it's when you pretty much stop listening and stop hearing. And I don't mean just actually shutting your ears off. I mean, in all aspects, stop listening and hearing and think that your stuff is the best stuff. Well, then you miss out on opportunities and you miss out on really important details that might be going on. And that's where you kind of see the decline. But absolutely, charismatic leaders or leaders with big, big, big egos can be incredibly motivating to those around them and really get the troops pumped.
And is that an occupational hazard, do you think, Bob, as people sort of make it through the hierarchy of work, is that you know, you have successes, you think you can do anything, you don't need advice from other people, it becomes a kind of self-fulfilling prophecy?
Well it's more than an occupational hazard. It's both a psychological problem and a structural problem. The psychological problem is we have all sorts of evidence that as people get in power, what happens is that they become less focused on the needs of others and more focused on their own needs, and they also tend to break the rules, act like the rules don't apply to them. And worse yet, and if you talk to anybody who's ever become a CEO, the first thing they'll tell you is that the kissing up goes up exponentially. And there's all sorts of evidence that if you want to get a promotion in an organization, what you should do is you should flatter your boss even falsely. All sorts of evidence that false flattery actually works, and not have your boss get the bad news. Just last week, I was at a conference with a bunch of sort of wannabe CEOs, and the CEO gave them the advice that if you've got some bad news, get the intern to break it to the CEO they'll get fired and not you. So there is a whole bunch of stuff that, independently of personality, when you get in those positions, you get all the false flattery. And if you start believing it, well, you become Donald Trump, I suppose.
Well, that's interesting. And picking up on that, Bob, which is that in positions of power, people pay a lot of attention to those people. Obviously, your survival or your future depends on how they view you, how they see you.
Yep. When people have more power than you, and this even applies to apes. If you look at troops of baboons, the average troop member looks up at the alpha male every 20 or 30 seconds because the alpha male has the power. So there's an equivalent among us human beings.
So how do you suggest, Nicole, that if people work for an egomaniac boss, how do you suggest working with them? I mean, not everyone can leave and start their own company.
Right. That's a great question. Well, I think, unfortunately, I'm going to give you a roundabout answer. Unfortunately, what ends up happening with the kind of the maladaptive egos, the big, big, big egos, is that we end up reinforcing those egos, right? Because a lot of us it's such an unpleasant experience to confront the person with the huge ego that might have a nasty ego. So we end up reinforcing that behavior by avoiding it. So sometimes really because we're protecting our own egos, right? In protection of our own ego, avoiding it sometimes is the best option because it's not going to get anywhere and we have to, you know, pick our battles. But with any person that's putting up huge, huge psychological defenses, you know, to cover something up or whatever it might be, it takes time and it takes patience and it takes the we versus the I. And I think that's really important because a lot of times when people have these huge defenses, and I'm talking about maladaptive egos, when they have these huge defenses up, they're protecting a weak ego, right? And
even if they're in a position of power.
Yeah.
When they may feel like
when
they're not.
Yeah, when it's a maladaptive ego, like when it's a dangerous ego, right? And, you know, they're shooting out. They're making people around them just miserable and the culture's declining. So with those folks, with the kind of extreme egos, it's really weak inside and they're protecting something. So focusing, and again, it's a slow, patient process and not all of us really want to deal with that, but it has to be about the we versus the I. It's more approaching that person as like, we want to get here, and this is what we're seeing, versus you are doing this, especially, obviously, with a person in power. It's the emperor wears no clothes syndrome. People that have those huge, huge egos that are negative often don't even realize it all the time because no one's ever saying anything.
But by making it we, you're saying don't do these battles by yourself, that you need to have teammates or
Right. We're doing this together. We're trying to meet these goals together as a company, as a leadership team, whatever it might be. And obviously, that's an ideal world.
Sure.
Because a lot of times avoidance does end up being the way that people can deal with it.
Are there also, and I think, Bob, you've written a little bit about this, which is that for companies, there is, it may look good to have a strong ego-centric person running the company, but there can be actual cost to things like that because you've got perhaps a disgruntled workforce, for instance.
Yeah, so I think of the difference between checked and unchecked egomaniacs or narcissists or jerks, pick whatever you want. And the unchecked ones would be the ones, maybe Larry Ellison at some of the worst points in his career, although he might have gotten better with age, or Steve Jobs. But it is interesting that I think we should talk about the context in which these people often work. And by the way, this might be the problem with Donald Trump. I'm not sure he's got anybody around him who can check him. But if you look at people like Mark Zuckerberg and Steve Jobs, who both got better with time. How good they got is a matter of discussion, but it's pretty clear that both got better with time, and both of them learned the lesson. Zuckerberg very early, by the way, to his credit, to surround themselves with people who can offset their ego, who can actually sort of clean up after them. One of the most famous people in Silicon Valley is a guy named Bill Campbell. They call him the coach. He was actually the coach of the Columbia football team till he was 39 years old. He's about 80 now. And Bill would go for a walk with also the CEO of Intuit. He knows something about organizations. Go for a walk with Steve every Sunday and sort of help him gain perspective. And to me, that's the hallmark of the narcissistic or the egomaniac leaders who are in check, is they surround themselves with people who can offset their weaknesses. And that's why, in some ways, I think the discussion of us just saying, well, it's the leader,
sure,
and I don't know, Facebook is Mark Zuckerberg. Well, Facebook is actually Mark Zuckerberg surrounded with a bunch of people who offset his weaknesses. And one thing about Mark, I will say, is he's a bit of an egomaniac at times. And especially early in his career, he lacked self-awareness. But he surrounds himself with people who give him realistic feedback, people like Sheryl Sandberg who offset the weakness. So a lot of times the answer is, who are the people who I surround myself and who do I talk with? And then you get a constructive egomaniac or narcissist, if you will.
And we're almost up on a break here. But what I hear you saying, Bob Sutton, if we're talking about Donald Trump, I mean, an easy target, I think, for our conversation, he doesn't have that, or he doesn't invite that kind of conversation.
Apparently not.
Well, I'll leave it at that. And let's take a very short break. That's Robert Sutton. He's a professor of management science and engineering at the Stanford Engineering School, co-founder of the Center for Work Technology and Organization, wrote a book called Good Boss, Bad Boss. Also with us is Nicole Lipkin, and she is the founder of Equilibria Leadership Consulting. That's here in Philadelphia, wrote a book called What Keeps Leaders Up at Night. And we are talking about healthy egos, maladaptive egos, egos at the workplace. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. You can also send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Nicole Lipkin and Robert Sutton about egos and egomaniacs and bosses that don't take advice and how to create a work environment where healthy egos are supported. And you can call us at 1-888-477-9499. Nicole, let me go back to you and something you said really almost at the top of the hour about the importance of self-awareness. I mean, that seems to me something that people should have through life,
right,
to know about your effect on other people. But if we're talking about either unchecked or checked egos, how does self-awareness play out?
Well, it's so vital. And I think, you know, I think we take it for granted that we all have self-awareness. It's obviously something that develops over time, and it's a constant struggle, even if you are a very self-aware person. But I think, you know, when you're looking at self-awareness, it's being able to see your impact on other people and kind of see yourself from outside your own lens. And that's actually a very hard thing to do because it takes a lot of energy. And our brains are designed to conserve energy at all costs. So we don't want to do that. That's why we have all these psychological biases. But I think one of the things that balances it out, and what Bob was talking about, the importance of kind of having I don't know, your ego check advisory council, is other people really can keep us in check. Because I think one of the things, and those folks that do surround themselves with other people to help them keep in check, that to me points to the idea or the concept of humility. Because a strong ego balance with humility, humility and compassion, these are grounding forces. And having that actually allows you to really investigate what you're doing. Is it right? Is it wrong? What's the impact? And I think it's so important. It also very much ties into, I think, the research about from Carol Dweck on mindset, which I find fascinating. When you look at people with big egos that are also humble and, mm-hmm. and surround themselves with people that they're comfortable, you know, being challenged by, these are people that have a growth mindset. And growth mindset means like, hey, my traits aren't fixed. I'm going to be constantly evolving. I'm going to mess up, and it's okay because I'm going to learn more if I mess up and figure things out. And it's okay. It's not a blow. Where someone with maybe an ego non-checker who has a fixed mindset where my traits are fixed, this is my intelligence, these are my traits. When they mess up or they're embarrassed, that's like a wound. You know, that's when things start crumbling. And I avoid saying narcissism because
it's loaded, isn't it?
It's a personality disorder. It's a psychological disorder that has a huge impact on the individual's interpersonal relationships, but also those around them. So an ego non-checker. Bob, I love the checked and non-checked.
Well, Bob, let me toss the humility word to you. How do you see humility working out, especially in positions of authority, positions of power?
Well, so I really like the emphasis on humility, and I would put it slightly differently, but I think we're going the same place, which to me that the best leaders, kind of independently of the veneer, because we've got to be careful because the way people come across versus the way their brains operate are different. In our research, we describe these as wise leaders, people who are confident, that they act absolutely determined what we're doing right now is absolutely the correct thing, but always in the back of their mind is what are the signs that things are actually going wrong and this is the wrong move. And that, by the way, especially late in his life, that was a lot of the ways that Jobs would operate. He'd push and push and push and tell you this is the way we're going to go until he was convinced he was wrong and he changed direction. And my candidate for the wisest leader I've ever seen in action and ever met is interesting because he argued with Steve Jobs for 32 years or something is Ed Catmull, who still runs Pixar and still runs Disney Animation Studio. And Ed's a very smart, sort of classic, humble leader, but he's very determined and he'll push forward until the moment when he decides, well, the movies we're doing isn't working, and then he'll fire the director. And sometimes that's necessary. But Ed would be my candidate. He wrote a book called Creativity Incorporated, which is absolutely wonderful. But I think that Nicole actually has nailed it, that when you look at the great leaders, Sheryl Sandberg operates exactly like this. She's very confident. She gets her team motivated, but she's also listens and is always saying, okay, what's going wrong? What direction do we have to change? And that combination of confidence and humility is a rare thing. And a lot of times it doesn't just happen. I would really emphasize this. It doesn't just happen at the individual level. It somehow or another happens in a functional team. And in a lot of ways, all of us have flaws and we need to look for people who have, compensating strengths or whatever. And that's what I think the great leaders do. They build teams.
Well, would it be, Nicole, if someone enjoys going to work, is that the sign that you probably work for someone with a healthy adaptive ego?
Maybe, maybe not. I think we all have different levels of resilience, and grit, and have different abilities to let things slide off our shoulders. And some people that internalize it and take it and it destroys them, I mean, when I think about my bad boss experience, I left work crying every day. I was not resilient at that point. When I was in my working, having this bad experience, I wasn't resilient. Now, through self-awareness, through my own growth, I've been able to look in when I've been in situations when I'm dealing with someone who has just this like super-sized ego in a maladaptive way, and I do run across that a lot. Now I'm able to approach it differently, but I think because there's so much more about the workplace. There's the teams you work, the social relationships you have, the work itself that you're doing. But I do believe that when you have a supersized maladaptive ego, the consequences to that can be so disruptive to engagement and the culture, right, because of something called emotional contagion. And we've all experienced it before. You know, if you're around a depressed friend, you start to feel down. Right. And when you're around someone that's happy or walking down the street and someone smiles at you, not in a creepy way, you smile back. You can't help it. The reason why this is not sexy at all. Our muscles, when they smile, it triggers happiness. It triggers the emotional center, triggers happiness. If you have a leader that is really maladaptive with his ego or her ego, it starts spreading to the leadership team, and then that starts trickling down. You can't avoid that. That's human emotion. That's contagion.
Bob, do you think there are gender differences when it comes to egos or maladaptive or adaptive egos at the workplace? Are women viewed differently from men?
Well, I think the main evidence we can see about gender differences, there are small gender differences, but the main issues are the nature of the stereotypes we have for women versus men, frankly. And as my wife, who's CEO of a nonprofit, puts it, good summary of the evidence. For men, us guys, we get to kind of walk on a balance beam between being sort of strong-willed and emotional versus sort of like nice and warm and stuff like that. So nasty versus nice. Where women, they get a tightrope, and you can sort of see this. One of my favorite things is there's this thing called it's not the glass ceiling, it's the glass cliff. Look at who mm-hmm. we are giving jobs as CEOs. We give women the worst jobs. So Mary Barra at General Motors, the company is a mess. Marissa Mayer at Yahoo, we give her that job. Meg Whitman found a job harder than governor of the state of California. She runs yeah. Hewlett Packard, a total mess of a company. So my perspective on men versus women is that it's not so much the differences between how they act on Earth. There's small differences, but the main thing is the way that we societally define men versus women, and we're fundamentally actually unfair to women.
Do you like that metaphor, the tightrope versus the balance beam?
I love
Nicole?
It. It's kind of like a hotter spotlight on women. Love it.
And do you think women are as critical of women leaders as men are?
I think women can be so mean to women.
Know.
We are so mean to each other. And I don't know. I don't really know what that's about.
Competition.
So, and rooting from social comparison, which is totally normal, to see how you're doing and compare yourself. Am I doing okay? Am I not doing okay? But then it just goes that one step and can really cross over to jealousy and worse, envy.
And that's Nicole Lipkin, founder of Equilibria Leadership Consulting here in Philadelphia. Also with us, Robert Sutton, professor of management science and engineering at the Stanford Engineering School. And we are talking about egos at work, checking the ego at work. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. I see some calls coming in. We've got some email comments as well. RadioTimes@WHYY.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Let me get Chris from Frankfurt to join us. And Chris, go ahead. You're on the air.
Hello?
Hi there, Chris. Go ahead.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Very quickly, you've already touched upon this in some ways, but could it be that some corporate entities could be collectively regarded as expressing some of the characteristics that you're associating with the egoistic, pomposity and so forth? I only ask it because I know someone who characteristically comes home with reports from work of decisions that come down from on high that just seem so lamentably bad.
Chris, let me say, I'm not exactly sure where you're taking this. Are you saying that sometimes an entire corporation can act like it has a big ego? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
Okay.
That basically, yes.
Okay.
And I'll listen off the air. Thanks.
Okay. Bob, Nicole, looks like you want to answer.
Yeah, I was going to say, absolutely, but it always starts from somewhere. You know, I hate to open up the can of worms, but I think Enron is a great example of this. You know, Ken Lay, Jeff Silling, they could not be wrong. And that rank and yank philosophy where peers rated each other and the top 15% were fired and it was just this cutthroat environment, that trickled down. But what's so funny is their mission and their vision statement was like the most flowery mission statement of any company. You would never guess that what was going on behind these doors. But it has to start someplace. It doesn't just come from nowhere.
Bob, do you want to weigh in on that at all?
Yeah, I just to echo that I agree with that, that there are these things called corporate cultures, and you do set expectations. I mean, a classic company, which has now been absorbed, Merrill Lynch, one of the nastiest, most backstabbing places you ever met, and it started with the reward system, which was that how did you get ahead? You got ahead by stomping on the people around you. And to me, that's always a good diagnostic of a corporate culture. You ask, who gets ahead here? Is it the people who help others succeed, or the people who stomp on others on the way to the top? And by the way, a more recent company, if you talk to the people at Microsoft, that's the culture the new CEO is trying to fix, because historically they've had a culture, well, you get ahead by being the smartest person in the room and stomping on everybody on the way to the top. The old Citibank culture was like that too. Everybody will tell you there. And it leads to all sorts of dysfunctions. It not only makes people sick, it makes them harder to perform effectively because the enemy is us.
Mm-hmm. But would you say, Bob, that this is changing, that they're sort of a less hierarchical structure? People talk about teamwork and
no, it's just rhetoric.
Okay, just checking. You don't think it's changed at all? It's still cutthroat?
I think in some companies it's changed. I think throughout, if you look at it, what is it, despots and bad organizational cultures will always be with us. And being out here in Silicon Valley, not to name names, but most of the new flashy startups you're hearing about are pretty nasty places to work.
No, I'm sorry to hear that. We're here in humble Philadelphia.
We could use some of that humility.
maybe we could use some of that chutzpah that you've got out there. But let me get Steve from Reading to join us. Hi, Steve. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, great. Thank you.
You're welcome.
There's a great show. I'm just finishing a PhD in leadership and studied about clergy leadership. Hmm. But my question was about extroverts and introverts and how they have different styles. And there was a study I was reading recently that said in mainline Protestant churches, you know, that 60% of the clergy are introverts, but when you go to evangelical or fundamentalist churches, something like 85% of them are extroverts. And how does that relate to what you're talking about?
Well, that's interesting. I mean, interesting to think in terms of introvert and extrovert. Can you take that, Nicole?
Yeah, sure. That is a really interesting question, because I think, first of all, I think one of the things that I had to clear up, like introvert and extrovert has always gotten, it's always kind of a little bit misrepresented, because introvert really just means like when you need to recharge your battery, you have to do it alone. Extrovert, when you recharge, you like to do it in front of a group of people. But, you know, when you look at that, I think extroverts can be more charismatic. They can tend towards motivating people, all of that stuff. But introverts can really be misunderstood and also perceived to have huge egos in a maladaptive way. But because of their communication style. So if you have someone who's more reflective and needs to take more time thinking about things, they could come off in a way that's very off-putting to other people, making other people feel like their ideas are being rejected, when in fact, it's really just their style of communication that they need a little time. So ultimately, it does come back down to that self-awareness issue of being self-aware enough to know, to let people around you know, hey, this is the time I need to just process this, give me a second, or whatever it might be. So I think when you talk about introverts and extroverts, some of the kind of like charisma of an extrovert or the reservedness of an introvert can get mischaracterized.
And just picking up on your example, I mean, if someone is introverted and they have people that are answering to them, to say, look, this is who I am, this is my style, so when I don't respond to your idea directly, I'm not rejecting it, I'm just thinking it through. I mean, to be that overt about it.
Right, I think so. I mean, if you're an introvert with a reflective type of communication style, like, yeah, I need 5 minutes to think it through. I've heard what you said. Let's meet back up again at noon and let's go over this, because I need to digest this. I'm a big fan of being transparent with what you need and letting people know versus forcing people to mind read.
And saying, this is who I am, this is how I do it, and I want you to understand that.
Yeah, this is how I think. Let me take a few minutes.
What do you think, Bob?
Well, I really like the notion for leaders to basically explain to people what their style is and even what their weakness is. And it's a rare thing, but when you have that kind of trust with the people around you, you can be extremely effective. Here in the Stanford Engineering School, we got a lot of introverts. And I had a dean for 15 years named Jim Plummer. It took us all 3 years to realize that he was just an introvert. And when you first met him, he wasn't flashy. But eventually all this good stuff started happening. But he never said, I'm an introvert. Give me time. I have to think. I'm not going to be flashy. But it is amazing. People like that who actually think often make better decisions. So that's one of the great things about introverts is that they have the sense to actually ask people and to think about what they're doing. But I really like the notion of not only being self-aware, but communicating with the team you have about what you need to be successful.
An email
that's wonderful.
An email from Richard said most bosses are bad or best most bosses are bad or at best mediocre bosses. And he goes on to talk about his own work experience. And to you, Nicole, I mean, it seems like most people, you know, your boss is like, okay, maybe could be better, but not, you know, not a terrible boss like you had. I mean, most people, you just have to sort of muddle through, it seems.
Right. Well, you know, it's funny. And again, it's all based on our own perception, how we're experiencing someone or one simple slight we might have had. Bosses don't get enough credit. So I want to give bosses a little credit. Being a leader, being a boss is so thankless and so difficult. And you never really stop. You never really get to step out of that spotlight and just take a breather. So, you know, I think, you know, when you slight someone, maybe accidentally, that again, because of people's perception, that could be what they hold on to, what I said in the beginning of this conversation, when you're really trying and doing everything else great, but that one time you messed up. So I don't know if it's most bosses are bad. I think there are a lot of great bosses out there, but some are really, really bad and some are really mediocre, and that sticks.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation talking about bad bosses, more specifically talking about ego in the workplace, when it's helpful, when it's destructive. And that's Nicole Lipkin. Also with us, Robert Sutton. And you can join the conversation. That phone number is 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. And do stay with us much more after this very short break. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moskowane. We're talking about leadership, egos at work, checking the ego at work. Nicole Lipkin is founder of Equilibria Leadership Consulting here in Philadelphia, wrote a book called What Keeps Leaders Up at Night. By telephone, Bob Sutton joining us, professor of management science and engineering at the Stanford Engineering School. And he wrote a book called Good Boss, Bad Boss. And we have calls coming in at 1-888-477-9499. Let me play a clip from a show called Silicon Valley, in which the protagonist, a guy named Richard Hendricks, meets with his company's wealthy backer, a guy named Russ Hanneman. Let's listen.
So then it hits me. We can take this thing called the radio and put it on this new thing called the internet. And no one was doing it. No one. So we started hoovering up the deals. Eat this. Open your mouth.
It's very hot. It's good. It's good.
Good. It's the best. This whole place is. You call this place and they don't know you, they pretend they don't speak English. Mm. You see a single white face in here? No, you don't. Mm. Anyway, next thing you know, we IPO, stock triples in a day, and AOL gobbles us up. All of a sudden, I'm 22 years young, and I'm worth $1.2 billion. Now, a couple decades later, I'm worth $1.4 billion. You do the math.
Okay. Well, that's a gain of $200 million over 20 years, 16.66 repeating. That's less than 1% return. Inflation is like 1.7. I think CDs are 2%.
So it's less than a CD.
Well, no one ever got laid putting money in the bank. Am I right?
Well, that's a little bit of a put down of the boss there. But what really struck me, Bob, was the boss. First of all, he won't stop talking. He won't stop talking, and I know from some of the work that you've and others have done is that a sign of a, I guess, egomaniac boss is that they interrupt people all the time, too.
Yep. So, to me, I wish the problem with watching Silicon Valley is and everybody in Silicon Valley says this, it's all too true.
Oh, really?
And that actually is sort of interesting, because what you got is the sort of BSer who has power and is the investor and does all the talking and interrupts and so on. But you'll notice that what happened is that what he called the guy who's doing the startup is, those are engineers. And one of the interesting things about more technical people, especially those a little socially inept, and I think it's one thing that sort of helps, is he was just focusing on the facts.
Right.
And just as a more emotional person, I'm a psychologist in a school of engineering, I just love people like that, because engineers and other technical people are very good with facts. And it turns out that you can do a lot with facts. I mean, that's one of the reasons that Google has risen, Netflix, very evidence-based organizations. So you got all the BS from the bosses. But if you follow the evidence, wonderful things can happen, despite leaders who have many flaws.
So math works, Nicole?
Yes.
Well, sometimes.
Yes.
In these situations.
I love those engineers, too.
For the very same reason?
Absolutely. Absolutely. I mean, yeah, it provides the facts. Now, I think there's a melding of the two. It's also how to work those facts after you have them. And also dealing with the disappointment sometimes when the facts don't add right. up to where you yeah. wanted them to add up, and how that feels.
But also not being distracted by the boss's ego, right?
Yes. Absolutely. And managing that. I love that guy. I'm a fan.
Let me get to it. Looks like Colin from Lansdowne to join our conversation. Hi, Colin. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi there.
Thanks for taking my call, guys.
You're welcome.
How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you. I just wanted to shortly make a comment on a culture that I myself work in. We had been noticing, I've been with the company for over 5 years now, and about when I was starting, we've been noticing that ego and leadership were really getting in the way of us being able to be super powerful and present with all of our customers. So we actually implemented a 6-principle, 10-agreement kind of culture that we are, in effect, a corporation, less Silicon Valley, more, small business.
Sure.
But nonetheless, created a culture in which we all agree and thrive in living that involves us being present with our team, creating a positive energy that's felt the moment one enters a store, being a participant in a coaching culture. And I think that's something that is really lost, not only on the corporations, but also on small businesses.
Colin, I'm fascinated, and I'm also looking at Nicole's face here. Was this something, when you say we, was it the workers who organized this, or was this more top-down, or somehow everyone came to the same point of view?
That's the beautiful thing about it. It's actually a combination of those three things. There are three brothers that own the company, but nonetheless, there are about 45 workers, and we have biweekly meetings every other Tuesday, where we all get together and we share victories, we share challenges, we create a space for everybody to be open and honest with each other, from the person who's been hired 2 weeks ago to the owner that's been running the company for 30 years. We are all on an equal playing field when it comes to being able to share emotion and share challenges and victories that we are having. So, yeah, it was created by all of us, and it's something that we still stand with 5 years later.
Well, lucky you, Colin. I appreciate the call to Radio Times. And, Nicole, I mean, this is sort of the opposite of what we've been talking about.
Right. And, that's amazing to hear. And I mean, what I would ask Colin if he was still on this call is I would bet money that he's putting in more discretionary effort. He's loyal. Yep. His productivity is higher. His performance is higher. And he feels better. He's healthier. Mm-hmm. Because when you work for a place like that and your voice is heard, and when it's not this scary place to mess up or scary place to share your ideas, you just want to do it. You want to show up. And it's common sense.
Well, it does feel like common sense, Bob. And I mean, using Colin's example, why aren't all companies like that? I mean, if there is a payoff, if there is a benefit, and perhaps a benefit for the bottom line, why don't we all do this?
Well, we are all flawed human beings, but it's wonderful to see that it happens. There's two things that strike me about that story. One is that they've got what I would call accountability, which is this notion that I feel like I own the place and the place owns me. And in the best cultures, what it kind of reminds me of are hospitals that don't make fewer mistakes and learn from mistakes. Everybody feels obligated to help everybody else succeed. And to me, that is absolutely a beautiful thing. And then the other thing that I would say, that although all companies aren't like that, The number of organizations I've seen on the positive side that will go through periods of turnaround after they're broken, it is possible just because you're stuck in a bad organization, maybe you can get out, but maybe you can also help fix it. And it is easier in small organizations than large organizations. Mm-hmm. But that example warms my heart.
Indeed it does. I think it probably warms everybody's heart. Here's an email from Ariel who says, just as bullies on the playground choose their marks carefully, is there a certain personality type that continues to work for a boss with an unchecked ego? Also, do such bosses actually choose their marks with successful domination in mind? And perhaps only because, Nicole, you shared not a lot of detail, but the fact that you worked for a boss with an unchecked ego. Do you think you were a mark?
You know, I think it goes back to what Bob was talking about earlier with regard to power and ego. And I think this particular situation, there was a power struggle. And again, because of self-awareness, I hadn't learned yet to withdraw from the power struggle. So in that situation, yes, I probably was a mark. But I think that's a really interesting interesting question from Ariel, because I don't know if there's specific personality types that remain. I mean, it is masochistic to remain in the same place and get beaten up over and over, especially with bully bosses, which probably goes in even a step further. But I don't know if there's a specific type, but when you think about people that will stay in jobs after being bullied over and over and over, with bullying, like a kid on the playground, you get paralyzed after a while.
Yes,
and it becomes
learned helplessness.
It's
right?
Exactly. It's learned helplessness, and it's a feeling like there's nothing better because you can't see anything better. And also, fear is a huge factor, mm-hmm. and just the natural human resistance to change, and the fear that on the other side it won't get better. So when people are in that situation and they're getting pounded on by a bully and just constantly, you know, just harassed, whatever it might be, that mixture of situation makes it so hard to disengage, and I think it can happen to anyone.
Bob, any suggestions for people in situations like that?
Well, I think that Nicole said it quite elegantly. That my main suggestion in those things is, first of all, try to get out. But if you can't get out, or you're feeling too frozen, try to find people to give you support. And then the other thing that I would also argue, and we haven't talked about the sort of ways that you can fight back quite so much, mm-hmm. but the hallmark of people who fight back successfully against bullies is, number one, they document it very carefully, and number two, they sort of put together a posse of people who help them document and protect one another and help one another fight back. And it's really, because if you're just a lone person who's being bullied by a boss, it's very difficult. And there's research on this too, that if you can find some way to have a group of people to protect you and to fight back, there's some hope. And I hate to be pessimistic, but there's some organizations where HR and the legal team are so bad, even though you do everything right, they'll still treat you like dirt. And those are the ones you really got to get out of.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me see what Kate from Morristown, New Jersey has to say. Hi, Kate. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Thank you.
Sure.
I worked for one of these bosses.
Oh, dear.
I discovered that what they are really good at is one thing. They're good at looking great in meetings. I used to go to the board meetings in New York with this woman who was in the nonprofit I worked for in Princeton. And in the board meetings, she sounded wonderful. You would have been swept off your feet. She knew nothing. She was ignorant and a bully and everything bad you can think of. But in the meetings, she was absolutely terrific. She drove the place into the ground. She did a lot of really bad stuff. She was hired at a huge salary somewhere else, dentistry something or other, and she was fired 2 months later because apparently they didn't go for the song and dance. But I saw that she was like that, and so was the person who was the absolute head of the place.
That's
and I've seen and heard from a lot of other people that it's the same thing. They look good in certain situations where they get the job. Once they're in it, that's when the trouble starts.
And you're nodding your head, Nicole.
Yeah. I think it's interesting. I think in the long run, I mean, when you're going over to the – when we're crossing the line to the bully or even the narcissistic personality disordered leader – in the long run, and Bob, I don't know if you would agree with me, but in the long run, it always, I mean, it doesn't work in the long run. I mean, you might have a run, but you look at the Al Dunlaps of the world, you look at the Ken Lays, you look at the Jeffrey Skillings of the world, you look at even just sports players that have acted like bullies or big babies or whatever it might be. In the end, it doesn't play out.
They get caught, or the performance just is get caught, unsustainable?
Or the culture just declines, the company doesn't do well. I mean, they might do really fantastically, but then over time, eventually, and most importantly, like people like Steve Jobs, who was incredibly successful, unbelievable, but he also left a legacy of not being a nice guy.
Yeah.
So whether it be the decline in the company or the legacy that you leave, in some way, it bites you in the rear end.
You agree with that, Bob?
I guess on the whole, it's true. Steve Jobs is a different case, by the way. He was such a complicated person.
Yeah.
It's unbelievable. I think we should take him out of this conversation. On the whole, I do agree, and I always say that if you're a jerk, you got to keep being successful, because your enemies are lying in wait, and they will push you away. That's what happened to Michael Eisner. Once he slipped, he was pushed down. It also happened to Jobs early in his career. But there are some exceptions. The person who amazes me is Carly Fiorina, and honestly, you will notice that nobody on her team comes out and supports her. She was one of the most selfish, narcissistic, and not competent people I have ever – I know two or three members of her former top management team, none of whom will speak to the press. So the person who continues to – she has lost everything and really one of the most narcissistic and weak leaders, but she is really, really glib and really, really good on her feet. And I remember when she was CEO talking to a member of her senior management team about how destructive she was, how selfish she was, and she looks at me, the member of the team, and says, Carly ought to go into politics because she can't lead anything, but she gives a great speech and there's no deliverables in politics, and look what's happening. We got her and Donald Trump.
Well,
so I, for the most part, agree that time wounds most heals, but not all of them, apparently.
Well, we have a comment from Patrick. He said he used to work for Donald Trump. He worked for Trump for 15 years. He says in meetings he was fabulous and positive, no one could get a word in. He did have allies in the building, extroverts and introverts, was smart enough to consider the smart people around him, but he had a crazy ego. I mean, you know, these are complicated people, right?
Right.
Nicole?
Right.
Absolutely.
Absolutely. Talk about an understatement here.
Yeah, I mean, when you're going in that direction, Trump, or politicians, it goes back to what Bob said in the beginning. In meetings, in, you know, in presenting yourself, you can be phenomenal, but the people that you leave, the trail that you leave with the people dead behind you, that always ends up speaking up, and you can't just hurl bad things at people, you know, like some of our presidential candidates.
Well, Bob, we're almost out of time here, but since you talked about Carly Fiorina, we've talked a little bit about Donald Trump. Is there something about politics? I mean, you have to have a gigantic ego, it seems to me, to run for president of the United States, for gosh sakes.
Well, I mean, the problem with politics in general, one of the problems which I think we're both talking about, is what it takes to get elected versus what it takes to actually do the job are even wider than in the world of business by quite a bit, because it's a matter of playing this sort of PR game and extreme positions. And I liked at the outset that Nicole mentioned that bad is stronger than good. I mean, calling people losers, fat, all that sort of stuff. Like, we remember that stuff.
Yeah,
so that's, I think, the problem with politics. And one thing I would say that for those of us, you know, in the electorate, is that we shouldn't just look at our politics. We should look in the mirror, because you got to be careful. You get the leaders you deserve if you fall for that stuff.
Well, we're going to end on that note. My thanks to both of you. Thank you for joining us today on Radio Times. The clock is ticking here. Bob Sutton, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
And he's a professor of management science and engineering at the Stanford Engineering School, co-founder of the Center for Work Technology and Organization, wrote a book called Good Boss, Bad Boss. Nicole Lipkin, thank you very much for joining us as well. And she's the founder of Equilibria Leadership Consulting here in Philadelphia, author of a book called What Keeps Leaders Up at Night. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times and you can find out much more about the program. Diana Allen, our intern this fall for Radio Times. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of the show. Produced by Susan Greenbaum, Debbie Builder, Emily Bryant, and John Ahrens. I'm Marty Moscoe. Thank you so much for joining us.